Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're talking about sex trafficking in the Twin Ports. A program note, this program deals with a topic that some listeners may find disturbing. Let's begin by having each of you introduce yourselves.
My name is Linda Goki-Rindall. I'm the director of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Family Violence Department.
Patrick Atkinson, founder and executive director of the Institute for Trafficked, Exploited, and Missing Persons.
Christina Harkness, the director of operations for PAVSA, the program to aid victims for sexual assault.
Pat, let's start with you. Can you lay some groundwork for us? What is sex trafficking, and forgive my ignorance, but how is it different from, for example, prostitution?
You know, sex trafficking is a big part of human trafficking, and human trafficking happens when there's force, coercion, fraud. You're tricked into doing something, or you're made to do something that you don't want to do. That's the simplest definition of human trafficking. But the key principle there is they're doing it against their free will. One thing that happens in sex trafficking is not only is the victim being raped, because again, it's against their free will, but quite often it's photographed or videotaped, and then it's played again and again and again, and it's for sale. So that person's being victimized countless numbers of times, so their most intimate side of themselves, which is being forcibly raped, is now out there for billions of people to see.
When I first heard the term sex trafficking, I thought that's something out of a TV crime drama. But it really happens in Minnesota, and it really happens here in Duluth.
The core of human trafficking, of sex trafficking, is very much business. I have an MBA. The reason I got the MBA is so that I would understand business. And that is the crux of what makes up human trafficking and sex trafficking. Very simple, supply and demand. Somebody has a sexual desire. And sexual desires are some of our most profound, intimate, intense desires. And with the range of humanity, you have this vast range of sexual desires. Well, if there's the desire, somebody will step up and offer the product that will match that desire. And the more exotic, extreme, or risky the product that they're offering, the higher the price. The higher the price, the higher the profit motive. Period.
But it seems like such a non-Midwestern sort of thing.
It's Midwest in the sense, not the lack of desire or the lack of the production of a product to meet that desire. It's Midwest in the sense that we don't talk about it. I do presentations around the world on human trafficking and sex trafficking. Recently, I did a presentation at a junior high school in St. Paul. I asked the kids, how many of you have never talked about this before? Almost all of their hands went up. Later on in that same presentation, I was talking about date rape drugs, which, again, somebody gets mickeyed, somebody gets roofied. All of a sudden, they're acting, they're performing against their free will. I said, how many of you personally know somebody who has been sexually assaulted while drugged against their will, who has been date raped, who has been roofied? Junior high school level, St. Paul, Minnesota. 80% of the hands went up. If the parents had been there in that room, they would have been appalled because this doesn't happen to their kids, they think. But it does.
When we talk about sex trafficking, who are the customers?
Most often a man, but it could also be a woman. Most often an adult, but it could also be a teenager. It's somebody who has a desire and the financial means or to buy that product to meet their sexual desire that they can't find a way or don't know how to meet through normal means. That is your potential sex trafficking predator. And I use the word predator because by the very nature of sex trafficking, they are using a victim because that victim is operating against his or her free will.
Is a person who buys a 13-year-old girl for sex, is he a rapist or a pedophile? Or something else?
He would not be a pedophile because a 13-year-old would probably be going into puberty. And a pedophile would be somebody who's pre-puberty. They would definitely be a rapist because a 13-year-old does not have the ability to give free consent. The FBI estimates that there are 100,000 child prostitutes working in the United States right now. children who are 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, by the very nature of their being under 18 and being in that type of a relationship, they cannot legally or even many times socially or personally give consent. There are cultures that permit the rape of women. There are cultures that permit the rape of pre-puberty boys. There are cultures that permit the beating of the women, the stoning of the women, the killing of your woman if you don't want her anymore. You can kill her. Some of those cultures have subcultures here within the United States, and those pop up in the court cases all the time. The same thing around parts of the world where you can buy a slave nowadays in 2013, not in $40,000 like in George Washington's day, but $80. You can buy a human being to buy and sell and trade and swap and kill. $80 in some parts of the world. The people who are doing it would say it's okay or it's an evil necessity. The victim, who's just as much the human being, the brother, the son, the daughter, the mother, would say it's the worst atrocity that they could possibly have been born into.
Let's talk a little bit about our community here in Duluth. Many people here remember days when women were brought aboard ships to party down at the harbor. And a lot of the stories that I've heard told are kind of told with this smile and a wink, as though this was some kind of lighthearted hijinks. Many still insist that with the advent of Homeland Security and some increased vigilance from the Port Authority, nobody can even get close to a ship, and therefore there is no sex trafficking in this community. I think that those attitudes indicate a view that this sort of thing is regrettable, but it's mostly harmless, and it doesn't really happen around here anymore, and so it's not really an issue. And I'm wondering what you think is the effect of that kind of thinking on the problem itself.
It's self-deception. It's self-deception either out of naivety or self-deception out of vested interests to create the image that there is no problem going on. Of course there's a problem because there's a demand. And if there's a demand, somebody is stepping up to offer the product. I was recently talking to a law enforcement official when I was doing some work out in the oil fields of North Dakota. They told me that 1 out of 7 oil workers will be sexually assaulted in the fields. Is it sexual? No, rape never is. 1 out of 7. Who would know that? You talk to the oil companies and they're going to say, well, that's not true. You talk to law enforcement, you talk to the emergency room personnel, you talk to social services, and they're going to say, our dockets are filled with cases. People generally operate out of a sense of self-interest, vested interest. Corporations, the same thing. The message that they're spinning is telling us there's no problem, it's done. Does that mean that the men who are coming in, who have been on the ships for these, you know, many, many days or weeks or months, suddenly have no sexual desire? Or that their wives are traveling with them? We know that's not true. The girls, the women that are being taken, that are being used by the sailors, by the crews, some of them voluntarily, most of them, no. No person who's in healthy state of mind would put themselves through that degradation that happens with prostitution. It's not a clean sex act. It's not Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. You know, that's fantasy. That's Hollywood. It's people who spit on you, who urinate on you, who bite on you, who hit you, who pinch you, who put out their cigarettes on your flesh. That's not free will. And if somebody is saying, okay, please do that to me, there's a serious problem. And then diminished capacity removes the ability to give free choice.
In your position, working internationally with the issue of sex trafficking, where do you go from here?
One of my biggest goals is education, prevention. Stop the kids from being victimized. If we don't talk to them and tell them what to watch out for, tell them how to be aware, how to take care of themselves and their brothers and their sisters and their friends, they will be victimized because the bad guys know how to do it. If we're not talking to our kids and saying, look, this is normal, this is healthy, this is consensual, this is love, this is exploitation, this is violence, this is rape, know the difference and live the difference, then we're letting strangers who are in New York, Amsterdam, Los Angeles, decide those values in our children themselves.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. This evening, we're talking about sex trafficking in the Twin Ports. Our guests in the studio are Patrick Atkinson, founder and executive director of the Institute for Trafficked, Exploited, and Missing Persons, Christina Harkness, program director of PAVSA, and Linda Gokey-Rindall, family violence director of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. In 2009, the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center researched sex trafficking among Native American girls in Minnesota, in part due to the volume of reports out of Duluth. The report said Native American women and girls are uniquely vulnerable years before they're ever trafficked, due in part to something called historical trauma. This is Linda Gokey-Rindall.
Historical trauma is definitely a contributing factor to that. Historical trauma is the idea that historically traumatic events have happened to Indigenous peoples in North America, and it's still affecting us. For example, boarding schools are the thing that most people reference when they talk about historical trauma. Children being taken from their homes to government-run military schools, sometimes run by churches, and basically stripped of their culture. They were oftentimes beaten for speaking their Indigenous languages and lost a lot of parts of their culture that was very important to them, and it was all that they knew until white people came and took them away, essentially. And so because these children were often taken from a very young age away from their homes, their parents didn't know how to parent them. And because they were away for so many years, oftentimes until they were adults, they didn't learn any parenting skills from their parents. And it became this cycle of losing the culture and also not knowing how to appropriately and culturally, traditionally parent children. And that's still affecting us today. And there has been a lot of research done about how to counteract that, how to sort of heal from this. I've heard it called a soul wound. I've also heard it called blood memory, like remembering these things that happened generations ago. And it's not as simple as just getting over it.
It was astonishing to read that they began to phase out the boarding schools in the 60s and 70s. And the article pointed out this is 1960s, 1970s. In our lifetime, we're still seeing first and second generations recovering from this.
Richard Pratt is famous for saying, kill the Indian, save the man. Strip the Native children of their culture, of their language, of their heritage, of everything that is important to them, everything that they've ever known, and basically assimilate them into, quote, dominant culture, essentially white culture. It's really a sense of identity loss, a sense of not knowing who you really are, which can be very disorienting.
The article also talked about how the civil rights movement helped to give some credence and some validity to a lot of the wounds, not all, that African Americans sustained at the hands of white society. And yet that has never been a part of the way the dominant culture has dealt with the Native American culture.
I definitely learned about the civil rights movement in the 60s and so forth, primarily during February because it's Black History Month, but we never learned about the American Indian Movement. We never learned about Wounded Knee, Part 1 or 2, or really anything about contemporary Native culture other than these are the tribes that used to live here and they were killed off a long time ago. Meanwhile, my school was over 60% Native American kids, so that was definitely a disconnect between what we were learning and what we were living.
What is the reality of Native women and girls in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, when it comes to sex trafficking? What about the women and girls that you work with?
Reservations a lot of times are viewed as very desolate, depressing, sort of barren places. And that's not necessarily the truth. But there is, at the same time, also a very high rate of alcoholism, drug addiction, and sexual assault, incest, child sexual abuse, and that kind of thing, domestic violence, etc. And so a lot of young women and girls who have been victimized since they were children have ingrained into their minds that their bodies aren't really their own, that because someone used them for something for their own benefit without their consent, their body doesn't belong to them anymore. And I think that can definitely contribute to being coerced into prostitution, sex trafficking. It can definitely do a number on your self-esteem if you have been abused and beaten and raped multiple times, which many Native women are. American Indian women and girls are, I believe the most recent statistic I've read is 3.5 times more likely to be raped than the general population. And that's with a lot of underreporting. sexual assault and domestic violence are not traditions in most Native cultures. Respecting women and treating them with reverence, because women were really at the centers of our communities pre-contact, that is a traditional value. And because colonization has impacted our communities so forcefully, that has definitely changed. There are a lot of efforts on a lot of different reservations to reverse that, but it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of work and a lot of healing, and it's definitely not an overnight process. Personally, in my work, I strive to be as culturally sensitive as possible. So working with Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, women and girls, I try to incorporate as much of our traditional teachings as possible, because that really does help with the healing process. In my experience, not only from historical trauma, but from sexual assault, domestic violence, and that was almost lost. We came very, very close to having our culture become extinct, but through the efforts of some very brave communities and individuals, we are starting to revitalize our culture, and that can definitely help with becoming more comfortable in one's body and in one's life, where you are on your path. I think that it's very reassuring to be working with a Native person talking about Native teachings, as opposed to a non-Native counselor, for example, a psychologist or an anthropologist or something like that, because there's a lot of distrust in helping professions. Often I put helping professions in scare quotes, because we've been analyzed to death as Native people, diagnosing us as mentally ill because we're Native. And it's definitely difficult to work with people who have been victimized, no matter what their race or ethnicity is. It can be very draining on a person. But if you add in a layer of distrust, it can be even more difficult. Traditionally, since women were at the centers of our communities, we had more power than we do now. Because Native women are victimized at such higher rates in the present day, it's pretty easy to forget that it used to be different, that it's not supposed to be this way. It was never supposed to be that we were being beaten by our partners, abused by family, especially because the family unit is so important in Ojibwe culture. It was kind of a foreign concept to even consider sexually assaulting a woman or beating your wife. It was very taboo pre-contact, but now it's sort of shifted and become the norm, unfortunately. But it is definitely very healing to know that that's not the way it's supposed to be.
As you work with Native girls and women in whatever capacity, where do you go from here? What do you try to accomplish when it comes to not only trying to prevent or deal with the repercussions of sex trafficking, but any kind of abuse or mistreatment of Native girls and women?
I'm definitely all about education and empowerment of Native youth, especially girls, because there are so many messages coming from media, coming from society, that A, Native women and girls are invisible, because we don't see that many Native American actors on the screen. We don't listen to music that features Native singers and stuff. And so without a whole lot of positive role models, it can be kind of depressing. Like, I'm absorbing all of this media and I'm not feeling represented in any way. And also, what about my story, my life experience? That's not something that people are talking about in the mainstream. And so I think that giving Native girls a voice is very important, making sure that their story can be heard if they want it to be heard, allowing them to empower themselves through telling their story or however they choose to express themselves, and also educating them, saying your body is your own. It doesn't belong to anyone else. No one can touch you without your consent, even though that might be different from what they know or what they think is the norm. It's definitely important for them to know that they can make decisions about their own bodies, that they can recognize that abuse is wrong, that it's not traditional.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. This evening, we're talking about sex trafficking in the Twin Ports. Our guests in the studio are Patrick Atkinson, founder and executive director of the Institute for Trafficked, Exploited, and Missing Persons; Linda Gokey-Rindall, family violence department director of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa; and Christina Harkness, program director of PAVSA, the Program to Aid Victims of Sexual Assault. PAVSA just completed a point-in-time study of sex trafficking victims here in Duluth, driven by anecdotal information provided to the agencies affiliated with Duluth's Trafficking Task Force. This is Christina Harkness.
Very often when a person has been trafficked, they don't know that they've been trafficked. They just know that their boyfriend has asked them to have sex with, you know, all these guys, and that's just kind of their reality. They don't call it trafficking. Usually when a person, usually a young woman, comes in for services, that won't come out until a little bit down the road that she has had this experience. But many of the organizations that are involved on the trafficking task force, we're hearing this from the people that they are working with. Very often when we go out into the community and do presentations, the very first thing that people ask is, well, how many? How many kids is this happening to? And you always want to say, well, how many do you need it to happen to for you to care? What we wanted to do was to create a study that was kind of based on the Wilder Homeless Research Study that they do in Minnesota. And so for the month of November, we had places around Duluth where people could come in and sit down and take a survey. We called it the point-in-time survey that talked to them and asked them questions about their history of being trafficked, if they've ever had, you know, sex for money, sex for shelter, sex for food. We call that survival sex, when there's an exchange just for your basic necessities of life. We had 63 people respond in this survey, and we found out things that pretty much confirmed what our partner organizations had been seeing. These were primarily women of color. There were 14 boys, actually, that responded to the survey. 20% of the people that responded in the survey identify as lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or queer. And most of the time, the people have been struggling with chemical dependency problems. A lot of times the people have been experienced homelessness either at the time of the study or within the last 5 years. Past sexual victimization happened in like 83-84% of people that participated in the study, which goes right along with what Linda was saying about people with a history of sexual abuse, domestic violence, but primarily sexual abuse is the key indicator for people kind of being funneled into being trafficked. They have those vulnerabilities. One thing that, when you were talking about the boarding schools, that I think is such a huge thing is sexual abuse happened at the boarding schools.
Definitely.
That kind of engenders that culture of sexual abuse and making that a norm in so many people's lives.
The St. Louis County Attorney's Office recently, within the last couple of weeks, filed charges of aiding and abetting sex trafficking in the first degree against two people, including one woman. I was horrified that a woman would do this to girls.
Right.
Is that really naive on my part?
Usually the situation when women are involved in perpetrating, it's not the fact that they are the kingpins that decide to set up these networks. It usually comes as a continuum of violence against women, where these girls that grow up to be perpetrators probably were the ones that were prostituted by a very violent pimp. And it comes down to being forced into recruiting or being beaten, you know, being afraid for your life. That might not be every single situation, but you really do need to look at each individual circumstance and to understand the many layers involved.
We have to remember that for a lot of human trafficking and sex trafficking, the people who are the perpetrators are looking at the bodies that they're buying and selling and moving and, you know, transporting around as nothing more than pieces of meat. And you'll get people who are men who will make money off it, and you'll get people who are women who are there to make money off it.
Women want to think that we don't do that sort of thing.
And I think a lot of victim blaming when it comes to sexual assault, sex trafficking, domestic violence, when it comes from women, in my experience, it's been from women who are protecting themselves by saying, oh, I would never let that happen to me. She must have done something wrong to have that happen to her. Her skirt was so short, it was no wonder she was sexually assaulted. I think it's kind of an act of self-preservation to think that way sometimes, because it's not on, in today's society, it's not on men to not rape women. It's on women to not get raped.
When these victims of sex trafficking arrive at PAVSA, what do they say to you about their experiences?
Normally, the way the pimps operate is that they will find girls that are vulnerable, and pimps can sniff that out like a shark in blood in the water. I mean, they can pick out a vulnerable girl or a vulnerable boy. They will groom them. They will buy them things. Oh, I'm your boyfriend. You know, this is fantastic. Look at, you know, you are such a young girl and you're going with me and I'm fantastic and I'm your daddy. Very often these girls will, you know, say that's, they call their pimp their daddy. Especially coming from the background of being vulnerable, there's just different levels of trauma that they've already gone through in their lives, and they are looking for somebody to love them. And then once he gets her hooked in, that's when he starts asking her to, maybe you can dance at the bar tonight, and maybe you can strip, and maybe you can, you know, do whatever he wants her to do. And once she takes that step, it's very hard to go back.
What happens to these girls and women afterwards? Can they recover?
They can recover, but when it comes to the level of trauma that is involved, if you are raped once, it can take years to recover. Picture being raped repeatedly. These girls can be raped many times a day. They're often afraid for their life. They're often in such a survival mode. It literally changes how you think. It changes how you view the world. It changes your view of what's acceptable, your view of safety, of what you'll do to survive. It's not just let's get them out of their situation. It's what do we do to rebuild their sense of self? What do we do to rebuild their health? They might have had, you know, several miscarriages. They might have had never seen a doctor for several STDs. Psychologically, they need counseling. They need education, as in job assistance. They may have no marketable skills. These girls can come in needing help in every single aspect of their life.
What we're not doing as parents, what we're not doing as a community, is we're not teaching our children the risks that bad people have in mispackaging those overtures of love and acceptance. And so somebody might come in and offer those, but for purely exploitive and harmful and life-altering self-gain. We do that with what we find on the streets, and don't touch that. Don't put that in your mouth. But we don't do that with strangers. We don't do that with their own body and saying, this is a good zone, this is a bad zone, this is a do touch, this is a don't touch. We have to do that as a population, as a people, for their safety. There are people who are so desperate and they have nothing to sell that they will sell themselves. But if that happens, society has failed them. Period. We can't let things get that far where they have nothing to sell but themselves.
Just the vital foundations for our society is, in societies all over the world, the economic empowerment of women and breaking down the cultures that say that this is okay. If you can go into a village somewhere in Guatemala or a block in downtown Duluth and you have women that have an education and have a means to support themselves, they don't need to become involved in this. They have their own money. They can get their own shelter. They can provide their own food. And if you can work in a society where women are valued, where rape culture is not the norm, where domestic violence is openly discussed and frowned upon, where sexual violence and date rape aren't the norm that's going on in the house next door or the campus down the street, that's where you have to set up those foundations to start to go forward.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Patrick Atkinson of the Institute of Trafficked, Exploited, and Missing Persons, Linda Gokey-Rindall of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and Christina Harkness of the Program to Aid Victims of Sexual Assault. We've set up links for more information on our website at KUMD.org. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson, with technical production by Chris Harwood, and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.